guys. I'm fantasy author J.H. Fleming.
And I'm science fiction and fantasy author Philip Dreyer Duncan. And with us tonight, our guest is the author of the Jiu City Chronicles. He has an MFA in creative writing from the University of Missouri. He lives in Kansas City, where he writes and acts, and he is also a contributor to Book Riot. Welcome to the show, Chris Arnone.
Thank you.
I got it right, didn't I?
Welcome.
Nailed it.
You did.
Nailed it. So much better than I did to poor William Ledbetter. How are you? How have things been?
Doing well, doing busy. New book just came out yesterday.
Yeah.
Which I know we were chatting beforehand. For those who haven't put out a book, it is a weirdly anticlimactic thing that happens. You just wake up and go, okay, now my book's out there. I'm going to go to work. So, but it's still wonderful that it's like out there. And, you know, a few people I know like sent me a picture of like, hey, look, I bought your book, you know. So that's,
yeah, that's the best. Yeah, that's nice. That is nice. It's weird. It's, I think the first one's the hardest, you know, because you feel like everything's changing for you. And then kind of nothing happens. It's just like, it's there.
It is a long game. For those who people who want to be writers, like, prepare. It is a marathon. The overnight success is extraordinarily rare. But the more you write, the more momentum you gain.
Yeah, and oftentimes when people think somebody's an overnight success, it's like, yeah, they're an overnight success after 30 books they just wrote over the last 15 years. You know,
Rebecca Yarros is a great example of that with Fourth Wing, you know, which exploded.
Yeah.
But then I looked her up and it's like, oh, she wrote like 15 books before that. She's been at this a while.
Yep.
It's still a level of success that most of us won't see. But again, she's put in the work. She's been at this a while.
Yeah,
that's definitely true more times than not, right? So tell us about the new book. Tell us about the Jiu City Chronicles.
So the Jiu City Chronicles, it's a cyberpunk kind of heisty, spy-ish thriller series. The initial seed for the whole idea was cyberpunk Catwoman, longtime Batman fan. And that seed eventually grew into a whole character and then a whole world. And I also really like to play with gender and sexuality in a cyberpunk space. Because so much cyberpunk, as much as I love it, it's oftentimes super, super heavy on the male gaze.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to push against that and play with that and, yeah, have a lot of fun with that. And so this is the second book in the series now, Necropolis Alpha. It finds our hero, Elise, kind of going head-to-head with this evangelical preacher who has this plan that threatens to disrupt the entire balance of the city. The city is divided up into five corporate boroughs. They're sort of like the old company towns. If you think about like the gold rush, right, where the workers worked for the company, and then they lived in the company housing, and they bought their food and everything else with company money at company stores. So they function like that, but on a much larger scale.
Okay.
But there's a precarious balance, and this preacher maybe will upset that whole thing, and that's not good.
Very cool. I like it.
Thing.
Are you planning on what's your thoughts for series wise? With this being the second book, are you thinking like a trilogy type thing? Are you wanting to do a series? What are you? You've got a face.
Right.
He's got a
Grimace
face on his look.
And then says 10 books.
10? Yeah.
10 books.
10 is a respectable number.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous
You already have
number.
All those planned out?
I mean, I go between plot and pants, right? You can't do a series without some measure of plotting. But I'm also very willing to sort of let a story develop and move and shift as ideas come up. And I mean, you both know that a novel, a single novel, is bigger than your mind can really contain at one time. And so there are so many more details than plotting 10 books is going to capture. You come up with ideas but still, yes, I do have the overall arc there. I know what the big secrets are. My wife knows what the big secrets are. And moving through it.
I hold mine to near and dear. I won't tell anyone. JH doesn't even know. Like, I had my very first series I started, which I haven't done anything else with in a long time. one person, and I refuse to tell anybody, and I met this one author who he's from Mississippi, and he had the big old Mississippi accent too. He was a prison guard. He was like a maximum security prison guard. He was a writer. And he calls me out of the blue one night. I'm at work. And he goes, "Hey, bub, we need to talk." And I go, "All right. What's up, man?" He goes, "I just finished your Moonshine Wizard book." And I go, "All right. Did you like it?" And he goes, "Yeah, man, I loved it. What's going to happen?" I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "I want the spoilers, man. I can't be waiting years for you to write this stuff. I want to know the whole thing. Tell me." And that was the only time I was ever like, "You know what? This is so off the collar. I'll just tell him." And so I told him my whole plan for it. And he was like, "That's great. I love it." And then that was it. He's like, "All right, good talking to you. Bye."
Well, hopefully he still buys them and reads them.
I haven't talked to him in years.
See, my wife knows the secrets because she's my alpha reader. So she's the one person who gets to read it knowing where the big arc is and what and so like what my regular reader is going to get out of it, but also knowing what the sort of other level is.
Yeah. Are you aiming towards it correctly?
She knows like any sort of weird motivations that characters might have of what they're doing to make sure all that works out. Cause I would love, you know, whenever I have a big reveal to people, like they could go back and reread and realize, "Oh yeah, he thought about this from the beginning. Like it was always there."
Nice. Yep. I dig it.
Nobody else knows though.
All right. So you said that, sort of the influence, originally was you were a big Batman fan. So what led you to the interest in cyberpunk? Where did those concepts kind of merge for you?
Well, I remember Neuromancer by William Gibson and Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson having a huge impact on me. I mean, those are two of the sort of foundational cyberpunk novels, and that genre has always interested me. And maybe it stems from me being intersex and having certain uncomfortable discomfort with my own body. Mm-hmm. And the idea of like, it's another thing you can own and you can change whatever you want. Mm-hmm. That was always fascinating to me. And then I think what pulls most of us to any speculative fiction is what it can say about the larger world, the political ramifications that sci-fi will often have through the speculative lens. And just, I love all of it. I've always loved cyberpunk. So
nice. But then you specifically went out of your way to put your own twist on it and change the lens a little bit. I like that. What was that just something that, through the years of reading cyberpunk and I'm guessing probably playing games and things, that you were like, okay, this is all, you put it really nice as the male gaze. I'll call it the bimbo gaze probably. was that something that always stuck out to you as like, I would like to do this, but do it differently? Or was that a more recent thing? What kind of led to that?
Well, I imagine when I first read Neuromancer and Snow Crash, I was not as politically aware as I am now. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't even hear the word intersex until I was well into my 30s, and then starting to think about, oh, that's me, it's not just birth defects, and starting to really understand how gender is a social construct. And I have a lot of transgender friends, and I don't think I could have said that back when I first read those books. But as my love for cyberpunk persisted, as who I am as a person grew, I started to see that more and more. And I mean, it makes a lot of sense in some ways with cyberpunk or any post-humanism, since the body is a thing you own, sex is there. And I do believe that sex work is work. And so being sort of open and flowing with that sure makes perfect sense, but that doesn't mean it needs to have a heavy male gaze. It's always hypersexualizing women specifically. Mm-hmm. And part of that is, you know, the sort of hard-boiled detective feeds into cyberpunk a lot. And that was, again, super heavy male gaze. It was always a dude who's the detective and, you know, the femme fatale character. Like it was all these very male gaze tropes. And so I was like, no, I don't need that. So especially like the first book of the series, The Hermes Protocol, I am purposely leaning in towards cyberpunk tropes and then pushing against them. There's a brothel scene, but you're getting to see how an asexual character navigates a brothel scene. Yeah, I played with that a lot, especially in the first one, to sort of tell cyberpunk fans, like, no, I know this genre. I know where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to mess with it.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that there's a weird thing we do where, like, where we lump all tropes together as being bad, but there are tropes that signify the genre in such a way that bring the reader into feeling comfortable with the genre. And then there are kind of the overused trite ones, right? So if done right, you kind of always, in a way, want to hit the tropes that make the reader feel comfortable in whatever genre you're in. So they know, like, this is it. This is a cyberpunk story. This is a sci-fi story. This is a fantasy. But now I'm going to put my own twist on it. I think that's what makes stories pop and really stand out to people, you know?
And it hugely depends on the genre. This me being the book riot hat who reads a lot of different things and talks to a lot of people who read a lot of different things, like, romance and mystery depend on those tropes.
Right.
Like, romance readers, right, they want those tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing wrong with that, right? Romance taught the rest of books how to sell books. But for some others, we have more flexibility. I mean, literary tends to eschew all tropes. But in sci-fi, we have that chance to lean in and push away and play with them and have fun with it.
Sure. So cyberpunk, but it's 2024. The AI are all coming to eat our livers and everyone just screams at each other online. We're living it. So where does cyberpunk fit in the modern era?
Cyberpunk, I might have to think about that one. Okay, back to cyberpunk. You know, this is really fascinating, and I've written a bit about this, because there was an article that came out essentially right as the Hermes Protocol was coming out about a year ago, that I was like, oh, thanks, universe, that was saying that cyberpunk is dead. And what it was claiming was essentially a big part of cyberpunk, of course, is this high technology, low life, right? These super powerful evil corporations. There's almost no difference between corporations and gangsters. You know, that there's no ethics or morals behind the technology. And why they said that that cyberpunk is dead is, doesn't that just sound like real life? essentially, we missed the point of all the cyberpunk, that what it was trying to tell us. But my point is, it still has a role to play in the 21st century. And I think for me that that is with gender and sexuality. If the body is another thing you own, I mean, so Elise, my main character, she is a woman. She is asexual, sex averse, asexual specifically, panromantic. Her partner is gender fluid and uses nanobots to change their body every day, like we change pants.
Interesting.
And I had a friend of mine who is transgender, non-binary, who is an author, who read this, and their blurb quote was on the front of the Hermes Protocol that said, a cyberpunk dream come true, because they were just like, this is the future I want. That's it. And so that's really sort of the space we can explore. And with the emergence of AI and the real threat of AI, exploring that as well. Mm-hmm. That's something that I do in my books as well. In fact, major plot point of the first book is Elise discovers a microchip. As soon as she touches it, it starts talking to her. And it's an AI that's not even supposed to exist. And that AI, Bastion, is still with her. End of book two.
Nice. I mean, really, that's kind of the gift of sci-fi as an overarching umbrella, right? Is there's always still a future ahead, right? So there's always room to play and do new things. So I dig it. Tell us about your acting. What do you do?
My acting?
Yeah. I know when we met, you didn't mention that part, I don't think.
What's wild there is, so like the first time I ever went to college was for theater, and I was a terrible college student. I went there for 4 years, racked up some debt, and then walked away without a degree.
Oof.
Yeah, yeah. But what's funny is when I met my wife, kind of accidentally found out that she was doing burlesque. And at that time I was like, I don't even know what that is, but cool. and that put my foot back in the theater world, because there's a lot of overlap there with the theater and burlesque worlds. And
sure.
So started to dip my toe back in there and get to know more people. And then suddenly it was in 2022, did an audition, kind of happenstance, ran into a friend. He's like, you should audition for this thing. And it was called Prejudice and Pride. a gender-swapped American folk musical retelling of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
Ooh, wow.
Correct. And so we did 3 weeks in Kansas City, and then we went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival for all of August. So I would work my job remotely from Edinburgh, Scotland.
Wow.
And then we performed the show about 30 times. And it was great, and I already adored Edinburgh. And if you can love Edinburgh in August, you will adore it year round. And then suddenly last year got a call, and we brought it back. We did 3 weeks in KC again, and then spent six weeks in New York City performing it off Broadway.
Nice.
So, oh, nice.
Yeah. So I played Luke Charlton. So if you're familiar with Pride and Prejudice, that is the pastiche of Charlotte Lucas, who is Lizzie's best mm-hmm. friend. And she's sort of the every woman that's there to sort of show you, like, this is what every woman would have been expected to do. And so that's, yeah. But I've done stuff here and there. I'm still occasionally do stage readings and whatnot. Done a bit of playwriting. I have a friend, Katie Gilchrist, who's doing this the 1994 project, because it was suddenly realizing for all of us middle-aged people that 1994 was 30 years ago. So all these things that came out when we were in our formative years are old, and it's weird and awesome. And so I'll be helping out with that. So I know in like April they're doing a stage reading of Dumb and Dumber, which I can't stand that movie. But my wife and I are playing the two like hench people. So I'll be like the guy who winds up dying from rat poisoning, and then she's like the gal who then disappears after that and then shows up to get arrested with the main bad guy. As we were watching this together, I'm like, wait, where did your character go? And then she shows up again at the end just to get arrested. It's like, okay. It'll be fun though. Like,
all right.
These stage readings, they're a love letter to the thing, but you also make fun of the parts that need to be made fun of. Like the parts that don't hold up 30 years later.
Well, that's fun. All right. Well, let's do, let's hit you with one more and then we'll do the news. What's your advice for the budding author? And it can be craft or business.
Do the work. I think it's so easy to slip into spending all your time on social media, spending your time reading about how to be a writer, reading about what you should be doing. None of that matters if you're not doing the work of actually writing. And that means finishing something. I remember I ran into a guy who said he had 19 works in progress going at the same time. I was like, you're doing it wrong.
Ooh.
You're never going to finish one. Like, you have to, you've got to keep working at it. And, you know, that daily work too, it just makes you better at your craft. But you got to put in the work and be patient. Be really, really, really patient, because that is the nature of this industry. It is slow.
Very true.
All right. I like it. I dig it. On to the news. All right. For the news this week, we will start with the writing world's drama of the week, because our industry is the most dramatic. This one's kind of wild. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the facts and explain what we factually know, and then I'll explain why everyone's upset and people can draw their own conclusions, I guess is fair. So of course this is about the Hugos, the Hugo Awards from Worldcon. I'm not going to explain what all of that means. I figure if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably heard both terms. But effectively, Worldcon changes locations every year, right? So a group will make a bid to run Worldcon, and then people will vote. And whatever group wins, it gets to go to their city or their country, whatever, however you want to say it, right? Usually it's like some local con runners. For example, the three of us actually were at World Fantasy in Kansas City this year. And the group who won the bid was a group who ran a convention called Conquest every year in Kansas City. So Worldcon this past year ended up in Chengdu, China. Now, I had read an interesting factoid that supposedly right near in the last few days where voting was allowed, there was a huge surge of voters who joined and voted for Chengdu. And that's how it won the bid. don't know completely. I don't have those details. Just thought it was an interesting tidbit. So the Hugo Awards, they happen at the at Worldcon every year, right? And one of the requirements for the group who is putting on or hosting Worldcon is that within 90 days, they have to reveal all the ballot information from the awards. And this past year's was basically kind of running late. It was kind of run up to the last minute. So people are already kind of like, hey, what the heck? Because it traditionally isn't a big deal. You have the data about who voted on what and you publish it. And, you know, that's that. But this year is running really late. And then it just came out a few days ago and there were some interesting things in it. For example, there were a number of authors who were marked or listed. Their work was listed as ineligible. Okay, fine. But there wasn't any further explanation. And, you know, when they have ones that, so sometimes if somebody gets nominated, they'll actually decline. And so in that case, you actually see author declined, something like that, right? But there were a handful of authors whose works were just listed as ineligible. One of the novels was Babel by R.F. Kuang, I believe is how you pronounce that. And it had recently won a Nebula. So you'd think probably it would be eligible. So the online community did what the online community do and started asking questions. This included author Neil Gaiman, who went directly to the source. Neil Gaiman approached a chap who is said to have been a vice chair and co-head of the Hugo Awards Selection Exec Committee. Let's call him Dave. Oh, says his name. And so basically Neil was like, what up, bruh? I'm paraphrasing. Neil Gaiman was like, what up, bruh? And and Dave was
perfect
like,
perfect impersonation.
Was that, did I sound like him? Good. I was trying really hard.
Spot on.
So Neil was all like, what up, bruh? And Dave was like, I don't know what you mean, bruh. And Neil was like, why these works be ineligible? And Dave was like, cause they are. And people were like, that doesn't make sense. Are you going to explain this? And he was like, I just did. And then he kind of was a little bit rude about some of his non-explanations. So those are essentially, I think, more or less the facts as we understand them today. Now, here's where it gets to the true uproar, because it's not bad enough that the integrity of this big award is in question.
The Hugos have integrity still? It's been a few years for the Hugos. Sorry, continue with your facts.
That's a science fiction trope, what you just said. Yes, this is a very cyberpunk story. So obviously, because the awards were in Chengdu, a lot of people are questioning, well, was this a censorship thing? Did the Chinese government come in and say, we don't like these books, get rid of them? So that's part of why people are, that's what they're suspicious about. And that's part of the uproar. But the other thing that has been pointed out about many of the ineligible authors are that they are of the LGBTQIA plus community. And so there are obviously suspicions and concerns around that. You know, did somebody just say, we don't want these and clipped them out? And the situation as it stands today, I don't know. Wait, we don't know the 100% answer on exactly what happened. And I don't know that we ever will.
And really, that's the biggest problem is the complete lack of transparency.
Yeah.
Right.
So like the big like committee official line, I will quote directly here. After reviewing the Constitution and the rules we must follow, the administration team determined that those works/persons were not eligible. And I know Zirin J. Zhao, she's the author of Iron Widow, and she should have been up for an Astounding Award herself and was deemed not eligible. Shared some screen grabs from, like, I think X, where one of the members of the committee was being, like, straight up insulting people who were asking for clarification and just telling them, like, what can you not read? Like,
that was our boy Dave.
Well, that was Dave?
That was our boy Dave.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and this is from, these are people who were actually disqualified. Rebecca Kuang did reach out, Zirin J. Zhao, Neil Gaiman reach out directly to them because they did not decline. Right. It's just this party line. Dave McCarty did say, and I have another quote, "Nobody has ordered me to do anything. There was no communication between the Hugo administration team and the Chinese government in any official manner." I'm like, but that's not actually saying no to Chinese censorship, right?
Nor is it actually giving an answer.
Correct.
Right.
And it's just, and it's been like 3 or 4 years now of hinky Hugos.
Yeah. It's more than 3 or 4 years. It feels like there's been drama around it since I've been writing. Which is weird because you don't really see that with the nebulas. You don't really see it with the world fantasy. You don't hear about it from like the giant romance cons or the, you know, giant mystery cons, unless I just don't hear about it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous. And the Chinese censorship, it may be the LGBTQI plus membership, but also Zhao has been openly critical of the active Chinese genocide of the Uyghur people, which, you know, China has been scrambling to cover up and pretend isn't happening for decades now, and it's still happening. It's like, come on, Hugos, you have a bad rap going on right now. At least you've been transparent before, and now you're just like, nah, we're tired of this one shred of dignity we had left. It's terrible. It's really, really terrible.
Yeah. So the thing is even though each Worldcon is ran by a separate group, there is still like a board that's sort of over, I guess we would say, the guidelines that go. So effectively, if a group wins the bid, they're given guidelines. Here are the things that have to happen at Worldcon. Here are the things you have to go do. And I can only imagine that what comes out of this is they have to do something with the awards, right? Like they have to, I don't know. Hey, at this point, I don't even know what you do, but they've got to do something.
At least transparency. I feel like if they were to admit that this was censorship from China, people would be angry with China, but there'd be at least a modicum of understanding of the Hugos having to do. Right now, it's just, it feels like a betrayal to be so closed off about exactly what's going on and exactly why these works and people were deemed not eligible.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think the only thing is that in fairness to the board, they may have no idea because just the way it's ran, right? They may legitimately not actually know. The people who ran it should know, right? Something happened where somebody went and wrote the words ineligible down, right? So somebody has to know.
Someone knows.
Right. Someone made that decision.
But the actual board of Worldcon who creates the guidelines and passes it out, they're probably sitting there going, oh man, I wish we knew because this is awkward.
But Dave McCarty knows. And he's not telling
us. Sure.
He's just attacking people.
Chris, he explained it very clearly. Do you not know how to read?
Oh man.
Zirin J. Zhao is going to get you. All right.
Oh, all right. JH, do you want to get us on the next news story? That's actual news and not just writing community drama.
Yeah, so the next one is actually kind of talking about Wattpad, which has been around for several years. Apparently, they have made an agreement with Penguin Random House, who is going to sell and distribute their titles. So what's interesting with Wattpad is, at least the last time I looked at it, it's been years now, but it was kind of like a self-publishing platform. You can upload anything you want to it. So I'm curious now for the selling and distributing the titles, like if that's going to be like select titles, if you have to go through a submission process or how they're planning to do that.
Well, it is. It's not a submission process. So it's specifically Wattpad Webtoon. Which is like, I guess a subsidiary their website is super unhelpful. I tried to research and understand who they are and what they do better. But like even trying to pull up the books, like they just wouldn't load sometimes. So I was like, okay, are you like, they have it separated by like young adult and adult. And I was like, okay, so they do both. And then I clicked on the adult section. I could never get a title to load. And I was like, okay, did they just, maybe they were like planning to do adult and then they were like, eh, we'll just stick with young adult, not a bit. I don't know what happened. But what it appears to be is that they specifically target stories that come out of Wattpad that they think are publishable. And then they act like a publisher. Basically, they'll go reach out to the person, say, hey, we want to publish this. That sort of thing is how it appears to me. And that specifically.
They being Webtoon?
Webtoon, or? Yeah. Yeah, they being okay. Webtoon. And then they publish them. And so now it sounds like when they do that, Penguin Random House is going to be the seller and distributor. So that's pretty exciting if you're one of the people who has had a book published by them, right?
Yeah.
But I wonder. That is neat. So you've caught me off guard here. I actually didn't know anything about this. I wonder if you publish a webtoon there and they don't pick it up, can you go somewhere else to try and get it published, like officially published? Or are you locked in?
So that's a good question. I don't know what Wattpad's I don't know what rights you give them using their platform.
I don't know either. Wattpad's always been a weird thing since I've always wanted to do traditional publishing. It's something I haven't really used because I was like, well, this is cool for self-published people. Get your work out there, but it can cause issues with traditional publishing. So I haven't really used it.
Right.
So I'm not saying you all have answers. I'm just like, I am curious.
Right. Speculating.
Yeah. Neither.
And it feels like there would be the, you know, whatever agreement Wattpad has with, you know, okay, these are the requirements to publish with us. But then if you want to go to, you know, say a small press or a big traditional publisher, so they would not be getting first rights at that point.
Right.
So it would be a matter of, do they do, you know, some sort of reprints or that sort of thing? Are they okay with, you know, having the second rights to it?
Yeah. I mean, typically books that have been self-published in any capacity, they're only going to get, I think almost no one takes a self-published title and is able to then sell it to a publisher. But what definitely does happen is, what definitely does happen though is, if a publisher sees a self-published title that's really, really successful, they might actually go approach the author. There's a few out there. There are a few that you can go see, you know, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, that'll be on the bookshelf, who originally was self-publishing their series, and it was doing well enough that somebody went and said, hey, would you, you know, want to come publish it with us? And then they do, and they just kind of change that way. This is interesting. So neither of us have ever used Wattpad either. I think that the way that works is it's meant to be more like you sort of in the sense of like an online journal type thing. Like you write your story, people can see it. I think you retain your rights to still be able to go self-publish it. I'm just not 100% sure.
Oh, that would make sense just based on the way publishing tends to work and copyrights for those intellectual properties tend to work.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think it's cool. I mean, anything that opens up a new avenue for people, it's good, I think. And, you know, Penguin Random House, that's a huge distribution flow right there, so.
Yeah, I wouldn't be mad if they were selling and distributing my books, right?
No.
All right, our next one is really good. I was really excited about this story. This is the one I'm most excited about. So Libro.fm, which is an audiobook platform which is focused on independent bookshops and authors, they have teamed up with some heavy-hitting authors like Ann Patchett, Jason Reynolds, and Eric LaSalle, I think is how you say that. Unfortunately, this very exciting news I'm about to share will be over by the time the episode airs, but that's okay because I think it's still really awesome and I want to shout it out for sure. So between January 23rd and 25th, 100% of what customers pay, not just like what they make, but what customers pay for some select books from those authors, every bit of that will be donated to BINC, which is a nonprofit dedicated to assisting booksellers in need, specifically independent booksellers. So that is really cool.
That's very neat. Yeah.
And I love that you're plugging this just because we should always plug Libro.fm. We do not always have to live in the monopoly of Amazon with like Audible. For like, I think it's, if you do monthly, it's actually $1 a month less to use Libro.fm instead of.
Oh, really? Audible.
Yeah. It's Audible's technically cheaper if you pay for it the whole year at once, but marginally. But the nice thing is when you sign up for Libro.fm, you pick an actual physical bookstore, not like Barnes & Noble. And it's as though that bookshop is selling you an audiobook. They get a cut of everything.
Oh, wow. That you,
yeah, that's how they work. So that's why I'm like, yes, let's always plug Libro.fm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, then they're doing this really cool thing, teaming up with these really cool authors. And you have to imagine, right, like the publishers have to be in on that if they're willing to.
Yeah, sure.
Unless the publisher's still getting their cut, in which case, wow, Libro.fm for just like paying all that.
Yeah, because then it's costing them a lot of money to do it, right?
Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like they're the way to go if you're going to pay for audiobooks. Like as much as I realize all my stuff's on Amazon, but also, come on, Libro.fm is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, when you were talking about it, it reminded me of bookshop.org, which allows you to, you know, pick an independent bookstore near you when you're purchasing, or if you don't pick one, like they will pick one for you. But yeah, same sort of concept where like you're actually supporting independent booksellers over like the major, you know, corporations.
A nice thing too with bookshop.org is they, so I know some like Wiseblood Booksellers, which is local to KC, their online storefront is bookshop.org. So they have a way for independent booksellers to use that instead of having to build their own online retail space. They can leverage bookshop.org.
Well, that's cool.
All right. Looks like the next one is mine. So we talked about Z Library before. It's a big book pirating site. So apparently publishers are sending DMCA takedowns to Google on like, what is it, over 3 million domains in 2024 alone.
That was just Hachette.
Yeah, targeting sites that are tied to the Z Library pirating site. So doing a little pushback against the pirates.
Yeah, this ongoing saga, right? So Z Library is the biggest pirating site basically in the world, and they are doing everything they can to not be taken down. They've had people be arrested. They've had all the big companies coming after them, and they're just like, no, we're going to steal your books and make sure you never get royalties for them. This is what we're going to do. Yeah, and it's interesting to see the publishers just are like, going to war over it. I guess it's interesting. The thing is, I feel like if they take them down, another one will take their place. And that's just part of living in this cyberpunk world that Chris wrote for us.
What's so sad about this is I think so many people justify this because they think of authors like Stephen King or Danielle Steele with their millions of dollars, or they think about the big five publishing houses that have all of this money. But it's like the vast majority of authors, including some that are like bestsellers, they still have to have their day jobs.
Right.
And it kind of reminds me of like the WGA strike. People were like, I saw so many people commenting, oh, all these actors are rich. I'm like, no, it's like 0.5%
tiny,
rich.
Yeah.
The rest of them are like waiting tables and scrabbling for every part they can get. And they need their union. And this is kind of that same thing is like you're stealing books and it doesn't matter who you're stealing from. And I always feel real bad, especially for like comics, where it's like, if you're a comic creator, you're not rich. Like very, very few of them get rich off of writing comics. They may make a good living, but they're constantly working. And those things, they get pirated and turned into PDFs and distributed so fast. It's just so sad. Like, pay artists for their work.
Crazy.
Use the library.
Right. The good news is, as we've covered the last few weeks, library usage is way up from where it is, like growing year over year, which is great.
It's great because libraries buy books for you to borrow. Libraries help authors. You don't have to steal them. You can just borrow them.
Yep.
Yeah, I think
what a crazy concept.
Yeah, right. Well, I think people don't understand the scale, right? They don't understand that, mm-hmm. like, if somebody goes and buys one of our books, if somebody goes and orders a paperback, might end up with what, $2 or $3 probably. Yeah, somebody goes like and somebody goes and buys an ebook, we're like 99 cents to $2, you know. It, so then you think about like how many do you have to actually sell to make big money, and you realize it's astronomical, right?
Yeah, it's like I've sold dozens of novels. maybe I'm in three figures at this point. Okay, right? Like I have a day job. I also write for Book Riot. the books do not pay my bills. None of my bills.
To buy you a nice milkshake.
Ooh, maybe. Yeah. Like I got a three-figure advance on my first book. It has not paid out yet. Stop stealing books.
Right. It's rough out there. Speaking of it being rough out there, we've got a new scam to talk about. Woohoo! Scams. How exciting. Writer Beware wants us to be aware that there is someone out there with a fake Macmillan Publishing website, and this is of course Victoria Strauss put this up, and she had some nice screenshots in there where they put like the Macmillan Publishers logo and things, but the website's still pretty janky. But then they're like reaching out to people and they're like, we're from Macmillan. Would you like us to publish your book? And then, of course, we're authors. So we're like, well, yeah. And then they send an email and they're like, great. You just have to send us a check for X amount of money and we'll publish your book and make you famous.
And sadly, the people listening to this are not the people that need to be told about this scam, because they'll be like, well, yeah.
Right.
Yes, no one should ever make you pay to publish your book. It doesn't work that way.
Nope.
It's not ever. How it works.
Yeah.
Self-publishing on Amazon.
That's called a vanity press.
Yeah, it is a vanity press. It is always a scam. Like sometimes they might publish your book, but I mean, it's you're going to pay more in the long run.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you're self-publishing or you're doing small press publishing, you might wind up paying for publicity stuff. That's up to you. Yeah. You might pay for editing, but you should never have to pay to publish. It doesn't work that way, ever.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a very good clarification in today's world, right? So if you have a traditionally published deal, in fact, you can just put it in those terms, any publisher, any legitimate publisher is never going to charge you for anything. If you are self-published, then yes, there are things that you need to pay for as the publisher, like your cover and maybe editing, probably editing. Let's be real, editing. You might be paying for advertisements and things like that. That's okay because you have assumed the role of the publisher. But if you're working with a
publisher. Or even as an author, you're choosing to do that. Yeah, I have a small publisher. And with my first book, I chose to hire a publicist. And then on this book, I do pay for like Instagram ads sometimes to help bump things. That's me choosing to. I didn't pay for the cover. My publisher is just two guys. I don't pay for the publishing, right? They do a round of edits. Like I don't pay them at all.
Right. Is it Selena who always says money flows to the author?
Yeah, that is her. She will say it. She will say it. Until you'll never forget that it was her who said it. And she's right. You know, that is the gist. And I think that, you know, again, that's a very clear delineation that I'm glad Chris brought up that should be made over and over in today's world, you know, because historically it was literally just money flows to the author. Authors never pay for anything. And today's world, yes, you may choose by choice, not because anybody asked you to, anybody approached you, you might choose to go pay for advertisements or whatever to sell more books. That's fine. But definitely anybody who reaches out is like, we'll publish your book for blah, blah, blah. The answer is you don't even give an answer. You just ignore them and put them in the deleted pile.
Block.
Yep.
All right. Should we move on to tools?
Sure. Oh, you have a note about AI news voice.
Oh, yeah. I almost missed the whole AI section, didn't I? In our continued coverage of our AI... Oh, no, I did it all wrong.
Do it again.
In our continued coverage of our robot overlords... No stories this week. We don't have any AI stories this week. Sorry.
Just mine.
Yes.
Go buy mine. That's all you need.
The week we bring on the cyberpunk writer, we don't have any AI stories. Was that weird noise just now from me?
Yeah, it sounded like it was like your computer or something.
Notification of some sort.
Everything's supposed to be silenced. I'm haunted. Right. Tools.
All right, for tools this time, Chris is going to tell us all about whiteboards and laser printers, so I will pass that off to you.
Makes it sound like people don't know what those are.
Some don't.
Again, I'm middle-aged, so these are things that I use.
Go down to the antique mall.
That's right. Old people. So, Matt, whiteboards. I got to talk about whiteboards. I have three in my office hung up on the walls. I've got like two that are like 3 foot by 4 foot and a smaller one. And these, I use them so much for so many different things. Because, you know, a lot of time, I think, if you're not a writer, you don't realize writing isn't always sitting down in front of your computer and, you know, putting the words into sentences and paragraphs. Sometimes it's thinking. Mm-hmm. Like just thinking. And the whiteboards help me a lot because I'll start to, like, write down, like, what are the questions? What are the things that I need to do? As I'm trying to work through sort of a craft problem, like a character problem, to be able to write these things down with, and, you know, in an eco-friendly way where I'm not using a bunch of paper, can be really useful. Or like one of the things I love to do is, it's an exercise I called 19 ways. I don't remember if I heard this somewhere or if I just made it up.
We'll assume you created it.
We'll assume I created it. You feel free to take it. And it's basically if I'm stuck. So I have a very good, for instance, in the third book that I'm currently writing. Don't worry, there won't be any spoilers. So it's Dr. Corto, the CEO, who people met in the first book, is blackmailing someone from another company. And it was a good motivation to sort of leverage a lease in this thing. And then there came a point where I'm like, okay, but what's the blackmail? And I have to figure out what it is. Because blackmail is always a tough thing, right? Like, what is the thing mm-hmm. that you can hold over someone to make them do something they don't want? But you can only hold it over for them so far. And so I get on my whiteboard and I write down 1 through 19. And I think of 19 possibilities. And I make sure that I finish all 19. Because honestly, the answer comes up somewhere in the middle. And sometimes it's a combination mm-hmm. of these things, right? But to find the best one that not only like, oh, that's the exciting one, but it's also the one that speaks to the themes and it speaks to the characters, you know, all that stuff. But it's nice. Mm-hmm. It's not taking up a bunch of paper. And then a nice thing I can do, too, is I can take a picture of it, drop that picture right into Scrivener so I can keep it as a note and then erase and start over.
Yeah.
Also useful for storyboarding. Most whiteboards like mine are magnetic. So you can do like note cards and put them on magnets, or you can just do post-it notes and then move them around as you see fit. So it's a good way for me to sort of put my brain visually in front of me as I'm thinking through something mm-hmm. while I pace around in little circles around my office. Mm-hmm. So that's my spiel on whiteboards, if you have the wall real estate to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. If you don't, I used to do something similar, but my whiteboard I bought was, oh, what'd you think, JH? Was it like maybe, it was probably like 1.5 by 1.5. It was just a square. Mm-hmm. But it was small enough that I could actually like take it, sit down on the couch with my markers and kind of do the same thing, you know? And then I would do the same thing, like maybe take a picture or whatever. Or if I like was like, if my ideas were solidified, I'd jot them down on paper, wipe it clean, and I could just start again, you know?
Yeah. And then laser printers, I mean, really it's in there, any printer, but I feel like laser is the way to go when you're doing novels.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just many pages, and honestly, you don't need color. So I had one of my professors when I was getting my MFA, he would do all of his edits on paper. And also when I interned at the New Letters magazine, the editor at the time was so old school. Everything was printed out in old school manuscript format. And I'm not saying you got to go that far. For me, at least once for everything I write, whether it's a short story, whether it's a novel, I will print the thing out. And I'll do double-sided, but double space, because I do have that sort of manuscript training.
Mm-hmm.
It reads differently, especially from an editor's eye. You will catch things. And to be clear, I work as a technical writer by day. I am very used to editing things on a screen. But there are things I will catch in that printed copy. And usually this is somewhere around draft 5 or 6, right? I've gone over this thing and I feel like there's nothing for me to catch. And I print it out and I get my red pen and I catch things. And I know I'm middle-aged and I sound middle-aged when I talk about printers, but truly it is a game changer when it comes to that level of what you can do for yourself as an editor. Doesn't replace paying a professional editor, but it does a lot.
Right.
I can back you up on the love for a laser printer. When I wrote my very first novel, because I had no idea what I was doing, right? And I wanted to print out like 10 or 15 copies to hand out to my friends and families to quote unquote edit for me, because I didn't know any better, right? I was, you know, first novel, right? You have no idea what's going on. So I was like, where the heck? Like, I can't use a laser. And the novel was big too. It was 156,000 words, right? So it was like, you know, I don't know what it is. It's probably 500 pages or something, right? I don't know, 400, something like that. Or maybe not
600 in standard manuscript format.
And it would have been, yeah. So it probably was. So, yeah, you know, that makes sense with the cost I'm about to describe. So you aren't going to do that on a laser jet, right? There's just no way. And it would take a week. So I went to somebody was like, don't you have a shipping depot nearby or something? They can do it for you. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I went down to the shipping depot just like a mile from my house. And I was like, yeah, I got my book. This is what I want to do. I got this USB. And the lady was like, oh yeah, we do printing. And I was like, this is what I want. And she was like, oh wow. So she like called the manager in, and I can never forget. He was wearing a Kenny G. He was wearing a Kenny G t-shirt and he had it tucked in.
What year was this?
This is like 10 years ago. This is like 10 years ago.
No. Nobody was a Kenny G fan 10 years ago. That's like 20, 30 years ago.
Nobody's ever been a Kenny G fan. Nobody's ever worn a Kenny G t-shirt and tucked it into their pants wearing a braided belt. Actually, this man did.
No, that's the only way to wear a Kenny G t-shirt when it was 1992.
Well, so anyways, the dude was like, he was like, I mean, I can do this for you. And I was like, okay. And he goes, I'm going to have to charge you. And I'm like, all right, well, what's it going to cost? He's like, $300. And I was like, well, this is the price of being an author, I guess. And I handed him $300 and I sat in the corner, and, you know, an hour later they handed me 15 copies of my book at 600 pages probably. And I was like, this is not sustainable. How am I going to print my books to hand out to people? You know, how am I going to print out my manuscripts to hand to people? Of course, now, you know, we don't do it that often, but still, you know, I went and spent, I don't know, it was a couple $100. I got a brother, laser printer that does does 28 pages a minute it's more than that. It's like 60 a minute, but 28 if they're double-sided. So you can do a whole manuscript in like 5 minutes, and you can get cheaper versions of the toner cartridges and stuff that aren't as expensive. And yeah, we've been using that for years, and it's a beast, man. I mean, I bought that before I wrote my second book. So we're talking like 11, 12 years now.
Yeah, that's what mine is. And it's wireless and it's great. And, you know, old man me also thinks everybody should have a printer. It's just, it's handy and helpful for a lot of things. But again, I do it usually just once. I think on book two, I wound up doing it a second time, because I wound up making some fairly significant changes late and just felt the need to do that again, but usually just once. And then my wife, who's my alpha reader, I just make a PDF and she looks at it on her, her iPad. And
sure.
She's got an iPad Pro and she'll just mark it up with the pen there. And but she's not really doing an edit. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing. If you actually hire an editor, you're going to send them the Word doc.
Sure.
Maybe they'll print. Probably not, but it's not on you.
I do have one publisher. One of my publishers still requires a printed manuscript for the submission.
Last I looked, the Paris Review still requires printed, like, mail. I think they've probably updated that since. I haven't submitted to them in a long time, but they were one of the last holdouts where you actually had to, like, print it off and put it in an envelope and pay kind of ridiculous shipping to send it to them.
Yeah. I've come across a couple agents who require that as well. They want the printed in the mail version.
Forget your newfangled technology.
Right?
Do I want you to send it to me in 2 seconds at no cost, or do I want you to send it to me in 2 weeks at an exorbitant cost?
I just want to see how serious you are. Slush pile.
Right? I need firewood. Winter's coming on. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to ask, was it Jim Butcher who, like, I remember him talking about the printed manuscript and they had it, like, under their desk because, like, their desk was wobbly. And so it was, like, keeping their desk from being wobbly.
Yeah, he was telling this story about, it was kind of his villain origin story and how he broke into the business and stuff. And he had a college professor who knew an editor. And I guess when his stuff got good enough, I think they recommended this editor. So he sent it off and was very, very excited. And, so the lady had moved into a new office and her desk was wobbly. So she just grabbed his manuscript. So the first copy of the first book of the Dresden Files, before anyone ever read it, served as a balancing, I don't know what you call it, a wedge, a shim for a desk. A shim.
He and I have the same hometown, Independence, Missouri.
So. Yeah.
Mm. Yep.
Nice. Very nice.
Factoid, as you said.
Random factoids. Can't go wrong with some random factoids now and then. All right. Creatives on Fire?
Sure.
All right. So for Creatives on Fire this week, we're going to continue our trend of picking a topic on the author business and a topic around the financial independence stuff. And our topic for the writing side of it is appropriate because we have a traditionally published author with us. So I think we want to just talk about, if you're going the route of traditional publishing, sort of the least you need to know, the things you kind of need to understand. We probably already touched on the biggest one, which is you don't pay traditional publishers to publish your book. Chris, what's the least somebody needs to know to start pursuing that path?
A good agent can be your best asset. What's funny is querying can feel really daunting, right? Writing a good query letter, you can spend so much time writing a good query letter. Finding examples of accepted query letters is helpful. But part of that is you just got to take the time to not only craft a good query letter, but take your time researching the agents. Make sure that they're the kind of people who should be representing what you are writing, that they are actually open to submissions. Do your research and find your sort of dream agents, pitch them first, and work your way down the list slowly. Because once you have an agent, they're your advocate, because then they're querying publishers and you just get to sit back and work on your next thing while they're doing that. And they'll ask you things and, you know, and then they're also an ally as you go down the road, giving you feedback on your manuscript, helping guide you as to, like, what you want to work on. Hopefully they're also going to be really supportive of letting you follow your muse if it's a good agent. I know at one point I took a little break between writing book one and book two just to sort of refresh my brain. And I had like 4 different ideas. And so I just sort of, and I was equally weighted between all of them. So I just threw her the list. She's like, "Ooh, that one, I can sell that one." Right. And that's the agent's perspective is, can I sell this? And I got about 30,000 words. And I got about 30,000 words into it. And then I switched back over and wrote Necropolis Alpha. I had sort of cleansed my palate. I'll go back to that one. It has nothing to do with cyberpunk or sci-fi or anything. It's totally different thing. But it was good to know, like, this is a thing I can keep plugging away at. That's your ally. That's the person who, like, they have a vested interest in your success. And again, you don't pay them. they take a percentage of your sales. You pay them nothing up front. So any agent who comes to you saying, well, if you pay me this, nope, walk away. Incorrect.
Yep.
Accurate. All right, JH, what else is the least they need to know to pursue the traditional path?
Oh, gosh. I would probably talk about the timelines. We mentioned a bit that you have to have a lot of patience, and that is because everything takes forever from the moment you finish your book. At that point, you get all your submission stuff ready, your query letter, a synopsis, you've polished your manuscript a million times. At that point, you actually start submitting. Of course, if you're doing it right, you'll have researched agents at that point. You're taking notes about who's at what agency, who's open, what other things they've represented. But you may be at that stage for years and submitting over and over and over, just, you know, because, you know, it's not the right time. You didn't find the right one yet. So you expect that part to take a long time. And then once you get an agent, it's kind of starting all over with them submitting to publishers. And it can, again, be years to get any of your books accepted by a publisher at that point. You may have started with, you know, a book that the agent really liked and they signed you on that one. That may not be the first one they sell on your behalf. It could be something completely different.
I can give you that exact thing on a very specific timeline, and that's mine. So I started querying for agents August 2020. Signed with my agent December 2020. And it was on the back of a historical fiction, new adult, maybe, novel. It's essentially what I wrote for my MFA thesis. She tried for a year to sell it. Basically, the biggest thing was, like, new adult isn't a thing anymore. People said it was the characters are too old for YA or too young for adult. So we spent a whole year. But during that year, I wrote The Hermes Protocol. And she sold that in 2 months.
Nice.
Now, keep in mind, the big five all passed on it, right? So all the big names said no for now.
That's right.
But then once I sold it, I think I sold it in March 2021. Book came out January 2022. Same thing with, I had Necropolis Alpha ready. I was waiting for the book to come out before I pitched the next one. Mm-hmm. They bought it in February of 2022. It came out, on the 23rd. So we're recording this on the 24th. So it'll be a little bit before that. So it's a slow process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's actually very fast even, right? Even
it is very fast.
You know, typically the smaller publishers are quicker, and that's fast by that standard even, right? Mm-hmm. I think I would go with, because you guys both touched on it a little bit. So I think one thing people should know if they're approaching this, and hopefully they're aware of these things, but if you are going the route of trad, there are some things you need to know, right? So I guess I can cover the very bone basics just real quick is, you know, the reason why you're I said something funny, JH made the face. I'll catch it in editing.
Just bone basics.
Last week I said condom because I don't know how to enunciate.
Who is Chad? Oh, he said Chad. No one says trad.
But the reason why you would be querying for an agent is because typically the big five do not take unsolicited manuscripts. So you need an agent to represent.
That's not typically. That is a hard rule.
That is a hard rule.
Yeah.
That is a hard rule at the big five and other, like, mid-sized, large-sized publishers too.
There are a few go ahead, JH.
I was going to say the same thing, that there are a few exceptions, DAW being one of them. Every now and then, what's the one I'm thinking of? Angry Robot will have open submission periods. Yep.
Bane maintains a slush pile.
Yeah.
So there are places.
Most of them are not open to unsolicited submissions.
So with that in mind, you need to, there are some terms that we've mentioned that you need to understand, right? You need to understand what standard manuscript is. You need to understand what your book's supposed to look like before you send it to them. And then you need to go check if they have any weird special things they want that are slightly different, because that will come up.
Mm-hmm. They all have weird special things. This is why you do your research. You must do your research.
Yeah.
Must do your research. Yep. Sometimes I think they have the weird things just to make sure you've done the research.
You need to learn what a synopsis is.
Sorry, I was just going to add, I've come across some who, in their guidelines, they say if you do not follow like this format exactly, like it'll just be deleted. Like they won't even read it.
Gone. Poof. I would. You know how much junk they get? Yeah, there's no way. The other thing you need to know is what a synopsis is and how to write one. And when you understand that, you can, don't be ashamed if you go sit in a corner and cry for a few hours, because it's... literally the opposite of what you've just spent the last few months doing. It's how to make your book as boring as humanly possible in a few pages.
Yeah. You write 150 words, 1,000 words. Great. Give it to me in one page. Include all the spoilers.
Yep.
Yeah, include all the spoilers. Listen, bub, I need to know what happens.
Okay, I got to see something reassuring, though, okay? Agents, publishers, they get a lot of really, 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 really bad stuff.
Right.
If you're a decent writer, you're going to get through that first blush of, ugh, okay? But there's so much that's not even about you, that's not even about your writing, that goes into those decisions. You can't control it. You got to let it slide off your back.
This is where you have to put on your business person hat and realize that, you know, you attempted a business transaction and it just wasn't going to happen this time. And it's nothing personal. It's not about you. Your product is not what they thought they could go sell today. That's really all there is to it.
It's can they sell it? It's not, is it good? It's can they sell it? I mean, if it's bad, it's bad and they can't sell it. But
is there anything crucial we missed on that in the least you need to know concept? I don't think so.
No.
All right. So moving over to the financial independence side, and I had talked about the Trinity study last week, and in hindsight, this is kind of funny, is sometimes it feels like things just shake out the way they should. I talked about the Trinity study, and the big thing is, it gives you sort of a framework. It's not a hard rule, but it gives you a framework for, hey, how much money do I need to be financially independent? How much money do I need to not have to have a day job? And the numbers can get pretty big, and that can get kind of scary, right? And I'll just recap that real quick because Chris made an eye face like, oh, that's interesting. So what this is Trinity College in Texas did a study some years back, and they were like, how could a person figure out how much money they need to never have to work again? How much money do they have to have? How could they determine that and do it reasonably accurately and never run out of money? And so basically what they determined was if a person's invested assets, particularly in, you know, like broader based index funds, S&P 500, things like that, basically what they determined was, if a person, whatever that total number is, if a person could live off 4% or less of that a year, they would never run out of money because it would always outpace them. In most scenarios, 97% of the time actually is what it said. So that's the basic. So it gives you sort of a framework. So people use that to go, okay, if I don't want to wait till I'm 65 to retire and I've got how many years, what can I do? What's 4% look like? But you start to realize like, oh, those numbers get very big very quickly, right? So if you need, you know, if you need 40 grand a year to live on, you need $1 million. And a lot of people, that's immediately where they stop paying attention to that. And they're like, well, that's never going to happen for me. But part of that whole financial independence thing is multiple kind of pillars of approach, right? So it's not just that one thing. It's not, hey, I went and got $1 million. Woohoo, look at me. And that it's all the pieces together, right? It's the years of investing, it's the years of saving, it's the years of determining how to reduce your expenses and things like that. But what was interesting that happened this week for me that was like, oh, that would be a good example, because I almost never would talk about my own money, just because that feels weird and either too personal or braggy. but I want to say something that feeds to that. So if you're someone who listened to last week's episode or is listening to this one, and you're thinking, okay, that 4% thing sounds great, but yeah, those numbers are astronomical. How could, you know, I'll never get there, right? So anybody who's been investing for a long time, they almost always say the same thing. Like the hardest thing is getting to like your first 100,000, and that feels like it takes for the rest of your life. But then after that, things happen much more quickly. And the reason is because the bigger the number is, the faster the compounding of the number, right? 4% of 10 grand is not as much as 4% of 100 grand. And so the higher your number gets, the faster it moves. It can also move down faster when the market's being janky, but it can move up faster, right? So I had not looked at my investments for a little bit. I don't really look at them too often. Otherwise, I start thinking about retiring and moving to a beach to write. and then wishing I had more in there so that I could. And I promise you, nobody has given me a large lump sum of money. This is just over the last, I really started what, JH, about six years ago now, learning to invest, learning how to cut our expenses, learning how to save and things. And like I said, nobody's given me a lump sum of money or anything. I'm not a millionaire or anything like that. But the market recently went up, which cool. I kind of like it when it's down because then I can buy more investments on sale. But it went up and I hadn't really looked at it for at least, I don't know, end of December maybe. And I saw that, you know, the stock market was at a high and I was like, oh, I should just poke my head in there and look. And in the course of that 3 or 4 weeks since I last looked, I'm $10,000 richer by doing nothing. I've done nothing to that, right? And that's where if you can kind of understand that and see that, then you can start to see, well, maybe some of those big numbers aren't completely out of reach. Maybe you can start driving that direction. And over time, you'll get there every day. You get there a little bit faster, I guess, is how you'd say it.
It probably depends on your age, too. I feel like when you're in your 20s, your 40s feel like they're very, very far away.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And now I'm in my 40s, as is my wife. We've, between the two of us, been investing probably both for her longer than me because she's older than me, but probably 20 years each at least. Mm-hmm. And 60 doesn't feel that far away anymore.
Right.
Now that I'm in my 40s. And so you can definitely see how it just, it does. Like we have a, we use a financial advisor mm-hmm. and he's a fiduciary. So again, like a good agent only makes money when we make money as it should be. And that's helped too. That's helped accelerate things as well. So like I just changed jobs about 3 weeks ago. So we're going to meet with him and I'll probably wind up rolling my 401k from the last job into an IRA with him, which he manages, and it grows faster mm-hmm. because he's paying closer attention than, honestly, if you've got a 401k with an employer, it's a good thing. You should do it, get your match, do all that stuff. But those are kind of passively managed. It's like a large group that barely moves. Whereas if you have mm-hmm. a financial advisor, they're really paying close attention and they know who you are. They also know what your morals are. And like, I know he's not going to invest our money in something that we would be morally opposed to, which is great.
I think the only caveat with that is I'm not 100% opposed to financial advisors because there is a learning curve, right? That people have to, you know, and to your point, if you have somebody who's, you know, paying very close attention, but the thing is you have to have somebody who has your best interest at heart, right?
Somebody you trust.
Somebody you trust, right. You have so to be important. Able to trust them. Yeah. Cause I once took a 401k and I thought, cause I didn't, it was before I knew anything about investing, right? I took a 401k from a company I'd worked at for about 12 years. And I thought, well, if I was an adult would probably get a financial advisor. So I talked to the only rich person I knew and I said, I need a financial advisor. And he was like, all right, I'll set you up. And so I went and met this company and it seemed very low. It was like, oh, it's just 2%. 2% out of your compounding year over year is a nightmare. But that part aside, I did that. I gave them my money and I thought, wow, I did that. I'm great. That was smart of me. And then I started to learn and I realized like, they're putting my money in the same investments that I learned in a few hours to put my money in. And I'm getting charged $35 every time they buy them and I'm giving them 2%. Like, this is crazy town. So in my situation, that was not great. And I ended up firing them and just did it all myself, you know?
Yeah. Our guy gets like 1%, and there's no transaction fees. Yeah. And, it's something like if you decide to go with a financial advisor, like keep an eye on it. Cause I can log in and look at the time. And when I saw him beating out the benchmarks over and over and over again, and his 1%, like it was like, yes, I am making more with him taking his 1% with what he's doing than if I were to just let it sort of passively do what it does in a large managed, lightly managed account. Mm-hmm. So you got to be careful with it and be willing to sort of go, nope, and pull out and try again. Or some people day trade. Okay, cool. I don't want to.
Yeah. Do your thing, I guess, you know, but that's not really what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Mm-mm. So then the only last thing I wanted to point out on that is I started reading a book the other day that I thought was really interesting and very insightful. And they talk about a lot of the things we've talked about in this segment of the show, particularly on the finance side, not the writing side. There's a new book out by J.L. Collins, and it's called Pathfinders. And what he's done, and I think it's a really neat concept, is he has pulled together these little sort of, in our world, let's call them short stories, although they're not fiction, from various people pursuing financial independence in various ways. People who started with nothing, people who made a ton of mistakes, people who are on their way trying to figure out how to get their investments and stuff right, to people who have already retired and saying, this is how I did it. Like kind of across the spectrum, it's a ton of different people in that sort of financial independence community, just giving a snippet of their story and the things they did and the decisions they made. And, you know, even things like one of them today I was listening to, the lady was talking about, you know, they were on, you know, trying to figure out their finances and doing things. And she ended up getting diagnosed with a very rare disease and sort of what her and her husband had to go through and how they kind of figured things out and found the light at the end of the tunnel and sort of their strategic moves. Super insightful. I've been doing the audiobook. It's interesting. They have a couple different narrators, so the voices change back and forth between each one, which makes it feel like you're hearing the different people, I guess. It's very good. If you have an interest in the financial independence side, would highly recommend checking it out, as well as his first book, which was Simple Path to Wealth, is a great book for just learning how the investment world works, kind of. All right. I think we've made an episode. Chris, tell the folks where to find you.
Oh, you can find me on Instagram at Chris M. Arnone. That's A-R-N-O-N-E. I'm also on TikTok now. I'm too old for it, but I'm doing it anyway. I feel like it's ADHD, the app.
I don't have ADHD. I hear old people in TikToks all the rage. You'll be fine.
but here's the thing, though, because, like, again, writing advice, like, it was my agent made me get on Instagram, and I talked to a friend who's a social media manager and who told me that for Gen Z and younger and some millennials, younger millennials, 70% of their purchasing decisions begin with Instagram and TikTok.
Believe it.
Go where the readers are.
We did. Who was it, JH, that had the report we covered a few weeks ago? Kobo? Maybe?
Sounds right.
One of the big ebook platforms did I don't know if it was a survey or just research they did based on their metadata. But they basically said that it was a weird thing where like 65% of people across all ages are most likely to take a recommendation on a book from someone they know, right? Like, so that was static across all ages. But then it was like millennials and Gen Z were 70% likely to take a book recommendation from BookTok or BookTube.
Yeah. Bookstagram. Yeah, it's important. So then you can also find some of my work at Book Riot. Like I know I just had published, it was the best comics and graphic novels of 2023.
Nice.
So I've got stuff published there all the time. My website, chrisarnone.com. And you can find my books pretty much anywhere that sells books online. And I encourage you, you know, go to your local bookstore and you can order it and they can order it, which is the best way to do it.
All right, JH.
You can find me at jhfleming.net. I'm also on pretty much all the social media sites. You can find my band Wildwood Minstrels on all the music sites. And I'm also on Patreon, Ko-fi. You can find some exclusive content on those sites, like short stories and snippets of works in progress. And you can also find me on Fiverr as an editor.
And as always, I am Philip Dreyer Duncan, philipdreyerduncan.com, and you can find my books at places books be sold. And this has been another episode of Future Bestseller. Thank you, Chris, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.